My name is Shredda, and this is The Lightner Side of Things, Practitioner Perspectives in School Psychology, a place for school psychology practitioners to come together and share experiences and insights about their work.
I am so happy today to talk to a fellow Lehigh alum, Karia. Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you? Thank you so much for having me. I'm super excited for to talk to you too, because it feels more like a catch-up session.
I know. I've been thinking about you for a while and really wanted to do this interview with you. But we went to graduate school together, so I know we have some similar perspectives in some areas.
We do. And luckily, we were also on similar grants back in grad school. So we've definitely been kind of, we've had the similar pathway to where we're at.
Yeah, for sure. The good old days makes me feel old thinking about it.
Yeah, me too.
So tell us about yourself, your training, your career journey and whatnot.
Yeah, so I did my undergrad at University of Maryland, Baltimore County. I'm from Maryland. And after that, I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do with my life. So I ended up doing some research in sleep medicine, which was really cool and kind of exposed me to all these different areas of psychology. And then after doing some research, I applied to grad school and ended up at Lehigh University in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. And I had the opportunity, and just like you, had the opportunity to be on several grants there that really kind of enhanced my understanding of the field of school psychology, gave me some real, you know, practical experience. One related to autism, which was then called like a low incidence disabilities grant, which we know it's not anymore. And then the second was the RTI grant, which was implementation of RTII in pilot sites in the state of Pennsylvania. So again, just kind of unique opportunities to build our skills as school psychologists. And also, I think, it, you know, and I don't know if you agree with this or not, but I think it gave us exposure so early on to like the different nuances of being in a classroom and having that like deep understanding of instruction, intervention, systems.
Yeah, definitely. I would agree with that.
Yeah. And then my journey has been interesting. I've moved a lot. So after graduating, I've worked in, I couldn't even believe 5 different states. Well, I guess 4 different states, because Pennsylvania, I did my internship there. But so I worked in Virginia and then moved to Michigan, then North Carolina, and now I'm finally back in Maryland. So I've definitely had some, you know, varied experiences in terms of what our field looks like in different states, but I think it's also given me a unique perspective on what it's like to be a school psychologist.
Yeah, it would definitely make you a little more well-rounded, I would think.
Yeah. And I think it kind of helps you see the parts of school psychology that are the same across states, and then also makes you think about, well, that's not how Michigan did it, or, oh, that's so strange, Virginia did it this way. But at the same time, I think it gives you just like a wealth of knowledge from different areas that have their like geographical areas with their own expertise, right? So it's kind of like a melting pot of information, if you will, in my brain from all of those states.
Interesting. So I know there's a lot more that you did in your career so far, but just going off of that, what have you learned about the field of school psychology having worked across these multiple states? Has anything really jumped out at you as being, I don't know, different or something that you really picked up on?
Yeah, so I think it's interesting. You know, I think we all know that our practices vary by the state that we live in, given kind of the different laws and policies, right? So like identification of a specific learning disability is variable across, right, in terms of where you live. I think the one thing that I've noticed in every area that I've been in is how much state law kind of influences and impacts the decisions that are made at the district level. And, you know, for example, several states have had kind of dyslexia laws and regulations that have been part of their legislation recently or in the last 5 years. And the the outcome of that has really impacted the way that we practice in certain areas. It's also impacted an increase in our knowledge as school psychologists about dyslexia. So things like that, I think it's just so interesting how much states differ in some of the, you know, I always think about like the retention law that all these states have. And we know as practitioners, right, like what the research is behind that. But you get into a school where the law mandates that if you don't meet a certain proficiency criteria, you know, retention is it. So definitely interesting to me. And again, I've also worked in small districts where, you know, there's only three high schools versus large districts where, you know, there's 160,000 students. So really seeing the variability of like district administration at those levels too. But I will say the one thing I've seen across states that I've been in is that school psychologists are always called as experts for systemic change. And that's always encouraging. So that was encouraging to me anywhere I went that our role was valued.
That is very encouraging. I'm sure, especially to those who haven't worked in multiple states or who may be having sort of a difficult experience where they are now, it's encouraging to know that the way school psychologists are viewed across the country is pretty consistent.
Yeah.
Do you think that some of those other inconsistencies, like you were talking about the retention laws, do you think some of that is problematic, or do you feel that it can be advantageous for that state, that certain things do need to be different state by state?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I think there are advantages and disadvantages to all of that, right? I think sometimes one thing I find myself doing is when I look at kind of the State Board of Education minutes or, you know, legislative items that come out of that, sometimes I constantly think, you know, it's hard when like you don't know if they're educators that are making these decisions, right? And it kind of makes me think like more of us need to do more and more advocacy at the state level and at the local level. For example, in a county that I worked in, I know that our director of literacy had gone to do some advocacy around, you know, universal screening practices or making strong decisions within literacy practices. So like she was the expert advocating for translating research to practice, right? I don't know that every state has a system for that. It certainly seems like some states are well ahead of the game in kind of understanding the research and translating that to practice, while others, you know, and again, it depends on who's elected, right? Like who has the ability to make those power and decisions. So that is certainly something I would like to see improve in states, that we continue to vote for candidates that we know like understand education and have the priority of our students in their heart, which unfortunately, you know, isn't always the case, as bad as that sounds. But certainly kind of I have learned just by working in different states that keeping an eye on that legislative body and kind of understanding how decisions get made at that level has a lot of implications for how the work that we do daily.
I like that. It was a little bit of a call to action to not only vote, but also maybe dip your toes in public policy and be the one who is actually running.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, definitely a call to vote. I don't know that I ever realized how important it was, you know, to, like, I knew it's important to vote, right, for the big elections and things like that. But I think seeing the impact on some of the things that I've worked in over the years, it really makes me think, you know, did I pay attention to that state board candidate or that local board candidate as much as I should have?
So MTSS is something that's close to both of our hearts. And that's in large part due to the RTI grant that you talked about at Lehigh that we were both on, and Dr. leadership and his mentorship. So talk about your work with MTSS and, well, let's start there. Talk about your work with MTSS.
Yeah. So I don't even know where to begin with this, right? Because I feel like I could talk about this for hours and just kind of wish Dr. Shapiro was listening. And maybe he kind of is, right? yeah. He's probably given us some kudos right now for having this conversation. So, you know, my journey with MTSS, like you said, really started where yours did with the grant at Lehigh and understanding systemic change, right? Like, I think you and I were fortunate to have some excellent, excellent supervisors in our internship that helped us elevate our knowledge around MTSS. When I moved to Michigan, I had an opportunity to apply for a position that was part-time school psychologist, part-time MTSS consultant, and I did, and I was offered that position. So in that role, I did my best to support elementary schools in the implementation of an MTSS model. So it was anywhere from, you know, how do you run your data team meetings, how do you make database decisions, all the way through training on progress monitoring, training district teams on what is MTSS and what does that look like in a school. So that was pretty cool because I got to work, you know, I got to work at the school level to work on implementation, but also work at the district level with district leaders in making some decisions or, you know, at least having a seat at the table when decisions were getting made. Then when I moved to North Carolina, I got another unique opportunity to work at the district level of a large county where I was supporting the work of district-wide MTSS implementation, and more specifically, you know, building equitable systems for supports in academics and behavioral health and attendance. So, and I still am a consultant for that district. So for me, MTSS has always been at the heart of what I do. And I think it will continue to be for as long as I'm a school psychologist. But I think I've just had some unique opportunities to be both at the district and school level, you know, trying to implement best practice and you know, advocating for them, providing professional learning on it. And again, continuing to increase my knowledge on MTSS.
Wonderful. I love hearing all these different positions that are out there for school psychologists. Not every school psychologist has to take that traditional school psychologist position. There's so many other opportunities out there and so much other work to be done within our realm.
Yeah.
So we had this conversation a couple of weeks ago about your MTSS work and about working at that district level versus sort of working at that building level. And I know we had a really interesting conversation about it. What have the challenges been when you're attempting to impact policy at the district level to reach the student level, as you so aptly put it?
Yeah, so I think, and I thought about this a lot too when I was reflecting on our conversation a couple of weeks ago, you know, So there are different, I think, barriers when it comes to impacting policy at the district level, right? Sometimes you're running into capacity and knowledge. So, you know, we have to build the knowledge and capacity of our district leaders because not everybody is on the same page about what an MTSS is, right? And not everybody, you know, went to grad school like you and I did and sat up at Mountaintop and read everything about CBMs, right? Like we did right. that. So part of that is building the capacity of the individuals who are decision makers, right? And it's not to say they're not brilliant at what they do. It's just that we come from a very specific background in understanding systemic change through an MTSS model. So it's that. And the other part about impacting policy is, you know, there are certain policies in procedures that are kind of embedded within the culture of a school system or even a school that are really hard to change. And part of that is because that's how it's always been done, which is like a phrase that we hate hearing. But again, in order to chip away at some of that, you have to continue to share your knowledge, which is best practice, which is what's going to give you the best outcomes for students. So those are some kind of district level impact that, you know, there are some barriers that can come with that too, because it's not as easy as just, I have to educate this person. It's also about the power and decision-making that person has that impacts other things, right? Like, so you could have a director of curriculum or director of instruction who is making decisions related to everything related to curriculum to diagnostics to assessments, right? So it's like kind of like that balance of how do we collaborate and communicate together to get on the same page about making the best decisions for children. And I think the other thing too is capacity, right? I don't think that we always recognize that not every position at the district level has the capacity to provide resources the way that all the schools need them. So like funding issues, like all of those different things that I never even thought about have a huge impact on what you see when you're trying to roll out systemic implementation of anything. So it's some of that too, like knowing and understanding how districts are resourced and funded to do the things that you want to do, right? So, and those are things I've only learned because I've had the opportunity to kind of be at or around the table when decisions were getting made about that. And to even extend that further, if a district has the capacity to train, they have the resources, they have the funding, then it's about follow-up after you do that initial training, right? So at the district level, it's not just like, let me convince these people that MTSS is the best thing to do. It's like 1,000 steps after that to get it to the school level. I don't know if that makes sense, but that's just kind of how I see it in my brain.
Yeah, sure, it does. It does make me wonder, though, how much responsibility does the building practitioner bear in that? I hear what you're saying about understanding where those resources come from and where that funding comes from, but how much responsibility does that building practitioner bear in terms of when they're asking for resources or making it clear what needs their building has or what needs their students have? How much creativity and how much, I guess, should they be tolerating in terms of what their limited resources are?
Yeah, I think that's a great question because I think that at the building level for us, it's what's happening right now, right? Like we need resources right now because we're putting out fires. We're dealing with crises after crises, right? So we don't have time to map out the funding source for X, Y, and Z so that we can get it implemented. Like we needed that yesterday. Right? Like that's the urgency that I hear and also see, you know, as a practitioner that not enough is shared as quickly as we've needed it. One of the things that I've always thought is as a building level practitioners, advocacy in places that you can control, right? So whether it's talking to your principal about like, hey, found this amazing free resource, I really think it could address this area of our school improvement planning, or I think it could address this issue we've been having with discipline. Like that's where some of our power lies at the building level, and building and kind of making those connections with the people that are in charge technically of our buildings in order to do that. But I think it's also difficult because, again, a building has to adhere to some of what's been shared by their leaders too, right? So like, it just kind of depends on where you have the flexibility to say, hey, let's use this thing that I found, or let's pilot this thing that I found. And I can see advocacy happening at the building level in that capacity. I know that I worked for a really great principal in Michigan. And if he's listening to this, he definitely knows who he is. Hi, Craig. You know, he was very innovative, right? So like he wanted to do what was best for kids. We were also strapped with resources and funding, right? So we got creative. Let's pull some free resources from the Florida Center of Reading Research and create a group for students who need support in vocabulary, right? So that was what we could control. And that's what we did because we didn't necessarily have the money to go out and buy a fancy thing, right? So again, I see us as school psychologists being able to tap into these things and share those with our administrators and hope that they take our lead on it.
So build those relationships with your administrators, with your leaders, and find that room for advocacy, figuring out what you can control within that.
Yeah. And I think the one thing I would encourage others to do too is we are consumers of research, right? So we read research articles or we read the communique with what's the best, like what are the best practices in our field right now? don't be afraid to slip that article under the door of your principal or your assistant principal or whoever is kind of in a leadership capacity at your school. Whether or not they read it the way that you did, it doesn't matter. It's that you're sharing that information with them, showing them the interest, like showing interest in something that is passionate for you, right? Like for my principal that I just spoke about, like he would always say to me, can you just Cliff Notes this article for me? Because I know you're going to read it. I don't have time to read it. So I would just do key takeaways, like the practices that we need to continue to embed are X, Y, and Z, right? It was a minor thing, but it helped translate some of that research to practice, right? So I would encourage us to do that. I mean, we have so many resources as school psychs that we can share. I think sometimes we're afraid to do that. So don't be afraid to do that.
That's great advice. And I was thinking the same thing about the Cliff Notes. Like they're highlighting certain things, giving Cliff Notes versions. Often I found the best way to communicate with principals who are busy and have 10 million things going on at once.
Right. I completely agree. I think highlighting an email with something or, you know, there were times where I would just say, hey, I found something related to this. I'm not going to tell you everything about it, but I'm going to tell you the most important parts when we have that 5 minutes together before that IEP meeting, right? By then, I had built a relationship to where he knew that I wasn't just giving him fluff, right? So in the beginning, it was more of like, here are the bullet points. But then it could be like, while we're walking in the hallway, I'm going to tell you about this cool thing that I saw. What do you think?
Right, exactly. So you gave some advice already, but as someone who's been in both roles, currently you're working, in addition to your MTSS consulting work, you're also working as a building practitioner. Is that correct?
Yes, that is.
What would your advice be to practitioners, if you have any additional advice, who are attempting to influence change and have their voices heard by decision makers in a district?
Yeah, I think persistence, right? So I think sometimes we get discouraged because we feel like we're saying the same things over and over again until we're blue in the face. We feel like we're the ones with three heads in the room. And so I would encourage you to continue to say that because change does not happen overnight, especially when there are policies and procedures that have been embedded into the culture of a district for a long time. So continue to do that. Continue to advocate for that, right? So if you are part of a union or if there is a union in your district, join the union, right? Show up at the meetings. If you have a union rep for your department, you know, make sure you share your concerns or you share the items that are relevant to us as school psychologists to advocate for change in policies, because that's where some of that change happens, right? It's not easy, right, to do that alone. So find your allies in how to make that change. Join your local school psychology organization if you have one. If you don't, join your state organization, because I guarantee you there are resources that are going to help you at the local level that your state organization can provide you. So definitely do that. You know, it's hard, though, because a lot of change takes time, and I think a lot of us want change to happen now. And I don't always disagree with that, but I think just patience and persistence. Keep showing up, because the decisions get made by people that show up. And that is something that we have to remember. So if we're going to stay in the background and then be upset about it, we're not going to make any change in policy. So when your supervisor or whomever, you see an opportunity presented to you, find a seat at the table, right? Like, just show up, and I guarantee at some point you will be able to make a small change. And it will feel like moving mountains, but it will definitely be worth it.
I love that. I smiled to myself when you said persistence, because there's another school psychologist, a colleague I was talking to, who described himself as annoyingly persistent, which I think a lot of us would describe ourselves that way.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know there have been times where I felt like, why do I feel like I say the same thing, but nobody listens? And then I had to really self-reflect and think, you know, how am I communicating that? Is there another way for me to make it relevant to what they're talking about, right? Like, am I just speaking my MTSS speak and I'm not relating it back to what this individual or this group of individual can understand? So that's the other thing, too. You got to sometimes make it super relevant, whether it's a scenario or, you know, it's So something to kind of catch their attention, unless, you know, because we can say all we want, like progress monitoring needs to have rates of improvement. And like people just look at us like, what are you talking about? Right. So I think we have to remember that we have to make that relevant, you know, especially for our administrators who deal with like 1,000 things a day. I don't envy that at all. Right. But if I sit down and say to my administrator, hey, I really want to talk about student outcomes. I really want to talk about what that means for school improvement. Those are things that they're engaged in, and they're going to want to listen to that.
Right. So the message has to have meaning for the other person, not just for ourselves.
Yes. So like know your audience, right? And do some research and speak their language to get your point across.
I like it. You are a building practitioner right now. As I mentioned before, what are the nuances and dimensions of that type of work that you encounter now that you don't think you encountered before?
Yeah, that's a good question. I thought about this question a lot because I think when you and I were talking about it, it was, you know, how do I, now that I've worked at the district level for some time and now being back at a school, what are some things that I see differently that I did not before? And I thought long and hard about it. And what I realized is, you know, it's kind of what we were talking about earlier, is that I see now where people get frustrated because we haven't gotten guidance on something. It's taken longer than we expected. And meanwhile, we already have 2 or 3 kids in crises and we're waiting for district guidance, or we're waiting for someone to tell us what we're allowed to do, you know, feeling kind of like, wait, but I have to support this kid right now. Like I have to do something right now, you know? I think one of the things that I realized is that there are hardworking people everywhere, right? So people are working really hard every day to get you the support that you need, whether you're at the district level or whether you're at the building level, right? And sometimes, I think the biggest thing I've also learned is that the decisions that come down from our senior leaders are hard decisions that they've had to make, right? And I've been in the room when some of these decisions are being made, and I've seen how they impact schools. So now being a practitioner, when I get a message or a directive about something, usually I would have been like, well, that doesn't make any sense. You must not know what I do in schools, right? I actually take a step back and think, I wonder what you were thinking about when you made that decision, because you were helping to provide this guidance for an entire district with all these variables of students and families and support, right? So like, I think I just see it differently. And I think I'm just a different consumer of some of the messaging that district level personnel provide, just having that experience. And I also think as a building practitioner, I have a more of like a bigger picture view. Like I always knew, you know, and I think you'll recognize this, Brenda Cabler used to say this to us all the time, like you're painting the picture for a child in this moment of time, right? And like, I always Yes. knew what she meant, but now I know it differently. Like now I think about a student from pre-K 12 versus just a third grade year that I get to experience you in. And I don't know that I would have thought about that had I not had the experience that I've had at the district level, if that makes sense.
That does make sense. It makes sense that your perspective and the way you take in that information and those directives may be slightly different or nuanced in a different way.
Yeah. And I think some of that really is just, you know, the farther you go into your career, I think you recognize things that you just haven't seen the same way before. And that's part of that. And again, that doesn't take away from the urgency that we feel as building practitioners, because for us, our job is to provide students everything they need to have the best outcome. And we want our districts to support us in doing that, right? And when your voice isn't heard, right, at the district level, that's extremely frustrating, which is why I was saying earlier, just be persistent and say the same thing over and over again. Find your allies to say that, because sometimes our district level administrators need to hear that over and over in terms of how it's really, really impacting students. And I don't say that because I don't think they get it. They're removed from the work. They're not having to see that student in crisis every day like we are.
I really like that you said people are working hard everywhere. I think that that sort of brings it back for me and sort of gives me a lot of perspective. And it helps me sort of center my views and my feelings as a practitioner. And remember that everyone has a job to do. Everyone is working very hard. And ultimately, we all really do have the same goal. We may just have different ideas about how to get there and different priorities at any given time, but we all have the same goal.
Yeah. And I think, you know, part of that too is there are frustrations at each level, right? Like, I know nobody at the district level is sitting here and saying, like, I don't want to get this resource out to you, right? Like, one thing I have to say is I have so much respect and admiration for school leadership that has to make some really, really crucial decisions and have some really crucial conversations, right? So whenever I've had the opportunity to be in those spaces, I have never, ever in one instance seen that their focus wasn't what kids needed, right? And that was encouraging to me because that doesn't always translate in the messaging, right? Like, you don't always see that, but they're the ones that are having to make those hard decisions that they probably don't feel good about them either. But there are certain things that they're bound and tied by too. And I have seen tireless efforts to get resources out to staff and students. And it goes the other way too. Like, I feel like at the building level, we work all the time to get students what they need. So I think it goes both ways, but I think there are certain expectations of district leadership, right? So I think for me, it's just stepping back and knowing, like, look, we're all on the same page. We just see things differently. And we somehow got to come to like a middle point where we provide support for each other, right? So I think it's hard. I think it's hard to make that distinction. And I still go back and forth in my mind about it. You know, so again, something that I'll continue to learn in my role and, you know, just evolve from that.
I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about something a little bit different. So you are a school psychologist of color, and you have the experience of being the only minority in a district, the only school psychologist of color in that district.
Yes, that's true.
Can you talk a little bit about that and what that experience
was
like?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I was reflecting back on that too. And I will say that thinking back about my time in that district, I don't really think that I even recognized some of the microaggressions that were directed to me or that were happening around me. I think that I was so kind of enmeshed in trying to learn the system, trying to do my job, that I didn't always recognize that that's what was occurring, right? And at that point, I was early in my career and I didn't really know how to speak up. I didn't really know if I could say or if what I was feeling was validated, right? Like I didn't have that courage to think about it like that. Like I just kind of thought like, oh, that can't be right, you know? And I didn't really know who my allies were either, right? So they didn't really have anybody I felt like at that point when things were happening to say anything. And quite frankly, it was uncomfortable. And now when I think about that, it makes me even more uncomfortable that I didn't say something, right? Fortunately for me though, I worked at some great schools when I was there and had some really, really great administrators who saw what was occurring and stepped up to support me in different ways. And I have to be honest, I didn't see it that way back then. To me, it just felt like, oh, they're supporting me so that they can encourage me and, you know, encourage me to speak up more and encourage me to advocate for myself more. But now I do. Now I see what they were truly trying to help me with, right? Like they encouraged me to kind of speak my truth and not be afraid of that. Like I remember one of our administrators actually saying to me, like, you can say what it is that you need to say. Like, I will support you. And that's huge because I don't think that everybody gets that opportunity, right? And so I had found some safe spaces and safe people where I could share my frustration or I could share things that were happening that were uncomfortable for me. And I had the opportunity to kind of debrief on that, to have dialogue around that. Now, I will say, I don't think that certain things that I had brought to the attention of administration were handled the way that I would have handled them or handled appropriately. But I do think that it was a learning lesson, like a learning experience for that district to kind of understand what it felt like to be a person of color as an employee there, you know, and I know for sure that they have taken steps to improve certain aspects of like kind of the core values of that district in order to do that. But I do have to say, I had people who really believed in my ability over anything else. Like they knew that I was capable of doing the job that I was set up to do. And that's what I needed to kind of get through that. And I think we're so much more aware of, I'm so much more aware of the piece about social justice and anti-racism now than I was back in the day. And while it was uncomfortable for me to be in those spaces, I think it really helped me grow and to be able to share this experience and encourage others who might be in a similar position to speak up, even if you are afraid, because I wish that someone had said that to me then. But it was definitely an interesting experience.
In your opinion, what can the field do to attract more people of color? Or even, I'll extend this even to graduate programs, training programs. What do you think, reflecting on our own experience, what do you think they can do to maybe attract more individuals of color into those programs and make it a more welcoming and accommodating
space? I think
space?
It's recognizing that social justice has to be part of the work that we do, right? It's recognizing that these topics are not like a course or, a part of your coursework. They should be embedded in all of the work that we do. I think that's part of that. So like having a sound, like having an emphasis on that would be important for individuals of color, and also recognizing that the children and the populations that we serve, there's so much diversity in the students that we serve, and that's not represented in our field in any way, shape, or form, right? Like, I think also, you know, one of the things that I have noticed in my career is walking into a room and I'm the only person of color, and then the parent, like the family, is a minority as well. I've actually seen families relax a little bit, right? Like just it's the unspoken thing. And I don't know how to put like a word to that, but I've definitely seen a more open and honest conversation when somebody that looks like you is also at the table, right? I think recognizing that as school psychologists is really, really important because we serve such a diverse population, yet we don't have that representation. So I would encourage graduate programs to think about, you know, how they're creating their coursework and how are they embedding topics of anti-racism and social justice and representation? Like that matters so much. And continuing to create and foster that environment, but be very careful in that, I don't have a better way to say this, but don't make me feel like I'm your token person of color. You know what I'm saying? Like, I think people have to be mindful of that too, programs especially. And I don't know that we do a very good job of that right now. I think we're getting better at that. But just kind of recognizing that fine line that this is a theme that should be embedded in our coursework and that we value the experiences of a diverse, diverse set of school psychologists.
Along with what you're saying, I would encourage programs to really make sure that they're truly committed to that work. And like you said, it's embedded in their coursework, in their philosophy.
Yeah, and I think that programs definitely have resources now more than they did before to evaluate the work of their program, right? Like the work of their coursework or assignments or what have you, right? Like I think there's more of an emphasis on that now than it was when you and I were in grad school. So while it existed, it was a part of. So I agree. I think it's important. I think it'll continue to be important as our student population changes, our families, you know, there's so many different languages. I mean, you and I went, interned in the same district, and you know, the populations that we serve, there were so many different languages spoken just within our small district. So that's going to continue. And I think as school psych programs need to catch up with that and And I also think we have more of a supportive network through like a mentoring program, through NASP and in several different avenues to encourage students of color to join the field of school psychology. There's more, you know, I think Dr. Barrett does, who is also a Lehigh alum, does the Exposure Project. So there are different things that are happening to encourage that. And, yes. And my hope is that we'll change the way our field looks.
You are a relatively new parent. So congratulations on your son. What have your thoughts and feelings been as a new parent while working in a new district during this crazy time? I don't know. I don't have any other word to describe it. It's just this crazy, unsettled time.
So it has just been, well, I can tell you, the perfect way to sum it up is I'm on Zoom on a parent meeting where my son and my mom, who watches him a couple times a week, walk into the basement and he's screaming. And that was my time to speak to the parent. And I just looked at them and I said, I am so sorry. And the parent said back to me, you don't have to apologize. My kid is screaming too. So I think that was a defining moment for me to understand that we're all in this together, right? Like as a new parent, I didn't anticipate being at home in a pandemic with my one-year-old and working in a new district. I'm very fortunate though that I work for this incredible school where one of the norms, and I can't quite remember the right wording of it, but our staff development teacher or our principal always says it is, don't worry about what's going on in your background. So like screaming children, barking dogs, you know, and there was so much comfort in that, right? Because I was being a new staff member at a new school and, you know, not having childcare, like my childcare is running late, or I got to hold my kid for 5 minutes while I'm in this meeting. Was so worried about all of that, but all of that was alleviated because my school had a norm for it. Like, it's cool. We'll make it work. So things like that have been helpful. And I think talking with other colleagues who are parents have been helpful too, because they say, hey, we're all doing the best that we can. And yes, we all have screaming kids in the background, and, you know, so it's definitely been an interesting transition, to parenthood and also parenting in a pandemic while entering a new district. But fortunately for me, I have a very, very supportive school staff, and, you know, Department of Psych is also extremely, just flexible about what needs to happen, because this is the reality right now, you know. But yeah, it's been a learning curve, and I didn't expect that as a first time mom to be doing this, but it's definitely has its challenges. But you just have to learn to give yourself some grace, whether you're a parent or not. I mean, I think everybody has to just give themselves grace for just making it through the last 7 months.
So I feel like I would be remiss if we didn't talk a little bit about Dr. Shapiro. He, I think, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe he was a great influence in both of our careers and the way we practice and our perspectives as school psychologists. So I was wondering if you have any memory of Dr. Shapiro that you can carry with you.
That's a great question. I'm thinking. Yeah, I have a really great memory that I think about all the time. First of all, I think about him all the time, right? Whenever there is a decision being made or something happening, I'm like, I need to call Dr. Shapiro. And I say it out loud thinking, you know, maybe he can hear me and maybe he will channel some way to give me the answer. I have this memory of him back in New Orleans and at NASP, and I was hoping I'd run into him. I knew he was there, but I knew how busy he was. I was walking into the exhibit hall, and he was walking out, and he said, "Hey, Harold," and I said, "Oh my God, I'm so happy to see you." And he said something like, "Look at what all of these people are selling. It's just ridiculous." And I started laughing because you know what he was talking about. He was talking about all the things he taught us were not best practice. And he was like, oh, just a bunch of fools, you know, and we laughed. And he said to me, this is before I even knew that my husband was going to be in North Carolina. He said to me, look, I want you to watch the state of North Carolina. They're changing their SLD policy to MTSS to SLD within an MTSS framework. I want to keep an eye on them and you do the same. And I said to him, of course I'm going to do the same. Little did I know that that's where I would be working just like a year after he passed. So that's one of my favorite memories of him. And my other favorite memory of him is I called him in January or February, or just a couple months before he passed. Of course, I didn't know how ill he was, but I had called him because I had had a meeting, which I called in my head really stupid, and I needed to talk to him about it. And I remember emailing him and saying, I really need your help. I need to talk to you. I don't know how to figure this out. I just, please, can I call you? And he always responded. And he said, of course you can call me. And I talked to him on the phone for maybe 15 minutes. I told him what I was annoyed about. And he just said, okay, it's all good. You're going to do this. It's all good. Just keep doing what you're doing. And that was the last time I talked to him. So I definitely carry that memory with me because he was such a big support to everything that I ever did. He always responded. He was always so proud. So I'm trying to think if there's anything else, but that NASC memory is my favorite because he was livid walking out of that exhibit hall and he wanted to make sure that I knew that. So that was pretty funny.
I like that. I'll always remember I had the opportunity to go to his service and one of his sons spoke. And what he said was, you couldn't fault him, Dr. Shapiro, for having such high expectations for everyone around him because he had even higher expectations for himself. And that really resonated with me. If anyone knows Dr. Shapiro, you know how much that fits his personality and the way he worked. So that's something I sort of carry with me and try to remember just to keep my expectations high.
Yeah, I love that. And, you know, I think he is the reason that we are the type of change makers that we are, because I think he kind of instilled in us that, you know, you have to be the person at the table that's going to be blue in the face and say what you need to say, right? Like, I think he gave us the courage to do that. I don't know that we recognize that when we were knee deep into CBM reports and just thinking to ourselves, like, oh, I just hope I pass this, you know, like that was my only prayer. Like, let me pass CBA, please. You know, but I think all along he was training us to be change agents. He knew what was coming with school psychology. He knew the changes that were going to occur and he was preparing us. And I think about him so much because there are so many things that I want to tell him. And there are so many things that I know he would say, well, that's stupid. Or that doesn't make any sense. You better go back there and tell them that doesn't make any sense. So in a way, I think I do tell him. I think I do just out loud sometimes say, like, oh, I wish I could email him, you know. And so I'm glad that we share those memories of him. I think that's important for the people that know him. And I think they can definitely resonate with that.
Yeah, wonderful. Yeah, Thank you for sharing those memories. On that note, it was so much fun to catch up with you. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and experiences.
It gave me a chance to reflect on my career. It gave me a chance to think about how I've evolved as a school psychologist. And I love that you're doing this, that you're highlighting practitioners and the work that we're all doing. So thank you for bringing to light all of these different aspects of our careers. And it was just so much fun to catch up. I can't wait to hear more of your podcasts.
Thank you so much for listening to The Leitner Side of Things. If you have any feedback or topic ideas, let me know on Twitter. My Twitter handle is @SGERA99. See you at the next episode.